But in many ways, the smuggling only made things worse. None of the smugglers were especially interested in charity. They demanded and got cold, hard cash for their wares, which meant Taro's limited and dwindling supply of hard currency was steadily hemorrhaging its way into the very pockets of the kingdom's enemies. The temple's refusal to extend its largesse to Gorgia had been a particularly painful blow under those circumstances.
"And things aren't a lot better now," he thought moodily. "Not that I can blame all of it on the Group of Four."
After Trenaire officially absolved Gorgia of having betrayed the Group of Four's plans, the kingdom had finally been grudgingly included in the church's building plans. Probably even that had happened only because of how much revision those plans required once that incomparable military genius, Elaine Maguire, finally figured out that they should have been building galleons all along. Gavin Martin, the Baron of White Ford, had made that point rather strongly in his own initial report on the Armageddon Reef campaign. That report had been summarily ignored, of course. In fact, there'd been some pointed comment about defeated, incompetent admirals offering up excuses for their own failures. There was a certain bitter satisfaction in seeing White Ford vindicated, although Gorgia wasn't especially surprised when no one in Zion bothered to make that vindication official. And there was no doubt that the change in the church's plans, with the sudden need for even more shipyard capacity, had quite a lot to do with the fact that it had finally begun placing orders even in Taro. The grudging nature of Taro's inclusion was evident in the number of ships the kingdom had been assigned, however. Of the 240-plus new-build war galleons the church had ordered laid down, only 22 had been ordered from Taro, despite the fact that Trangier alone could have built half again that many. And the kingdom had been directed to convert less than 20 merchant galleons for naval purposes as well. Even the Desnarian Empire, which had never really had a navy before, had been assigned twice as many vessels, and paid the absurdly inflated prices the Desnarian yards had demanded. For that matter, the church had helped build their damned yards in the first place. Unfortunately, Gorgia couldn't pretend the church's decision to throw such a small piece of the pie in Taro's direction had been motivated solely by pique. The unhappy truth was that Taro was the only one of the church's building sites which wasn't connected to the mainland. Carizian privateers and cruisers had stung, hampered, and pillaged the coastal shipping carrying naval materials to the mainland yards badly enough. Their ability to dominate the Taro Channel between Taro and Sidarmark's Windmore province had put a virtual stranglehold on any effort to get those same materials to Trangier. Timbers could be cut domestically and dragged, if slowly and laboriously, overland to the shipyards. Hulls could be built. Sails could even be woven, and rigging could be set up. But no foundry in Taro had the expertise to produce naval artillery. All of the Royal Taroisian Navy's pre-war guns had come from Carizian foundries, which, for some peculiar reason, seemed moderately disinclined to deliver their wares to Trangier just at the moment. In many ways, Karis had been ironmaster to the world, for not even Sidarmark or the Harchong Empire had truly rivaled the output of her foundries. Not only had it been far cheaper to buy ironwork, including artillery, from Karis, but the expertise, as well as the foundry's physical plant, had been overwhelmingly concentrated in Karis as well. So even if Gorgia had possessed unlimited financial resources, which he most definitely did not, he had no experienced foundry masters who knew how to build cannon that didn't blow up the second or third time they were fired. A couple of small domestic foundries were making some progress in acquiring the needed skills, but it was frustratingly difficult and agonizingly slow.
And as Whiteford's pointed out, it's probably not totally unreasonable for Cruz to be just a tad leery of guns that have demonstrated such a pronounced tendency to kill or mangle their gunners, he thought disgustedly. Well, perhaps this morning's meeting might usher in some improvement in that situation. It was unlikely, but a man could always hope. All right, he said as he settled himself more comfortably into the cushions of his father's chair, turning his head to look at the Chamberlain standing just inside the council chamber's door. Tell Sir Rick he may come in now.
Of course, Your Majesty.
The Chamberlain bowed, opened the door, and stepped out into the hallway. A moment later, a stout, stocky man somewhere in his late 60s entered the chamber. He was mostly bald, and his remaining fringe of hair had gone entirely gray, but his eyebrows remained bushy and black, and his full beard was only lightly streaked with silver. His eyes were a very dark gray, and his nose was decidedly crooked, having been broken in a shipboard brawl in his youth. He also walked with a pronounced limp, courtesy of the fall from aloft, which had ended his career at sea, and sent him into an apprenticeship in a Carisian foundry. In the decades since, Sir Rick Farman had become one of the wealthier foundry masters of Taro, until the majority of his wealth, like that of quite a few other Taroisian subjects, had been largely destroyed as a consequence of the Carisian blockade. Farman was still much better off than most of those other subjects of Gorsha's. In fact, he was in a position to recoup much of what he'd lost, because he was also one of the handful of people in the entire kingdom who had any experience at all in casting and boring artillery.